in class, yeah.
See, I told you. He is out. He's out working the crowd. You got to get started up. Maybe they'll take a picture of him not being in a seat.
Chris, this is not an election year for you.
Chris. Hey, Chris. He's ignoring us.
And she can't fix that ticket. Moved by Dr. Olker, seconded by Mrs. Dickinson. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, that passes unanimously. We have a presentation this evening, but before we begin with that, I did want to take this opportunity to announce that it is Russell Miller's birthday today. Our Assistant Superintendent of Business Services. And so, do you want the singing, the spanking, or would you like us just to nod our heads and wish you a happy birthday? Okay, happy birthday. And also, I'd like to note that Mrs. Andreen called me earlier, and she's delayed because her daughter is receiving an award at San Luis High School, but she will be joining us. So we move on to presentations. The City of San Luis Obispo report on community needs and service challenges.
There we go. Okay. Good evening. I'm Wendy George. I'm currently the city's assistant city administrator. I've worked for the city for almost 21 years now and kind of wandered through a lot of departments and jobs during that time. I'm here tonight with two other city employees, Bill Statler, who's our finance director, and Deb Linden, who's our police chief. It's really kind of odd for me to be on this side of the table. Some of you may know that I spent 11 years on the San Luis Coastal School Board in the 80s and early 90s. And so you're probably wondering, as I might have been wondering then, well, why is the city coming to us and talking about something called fiscal issues related to community services? But what I found out really more from working from the city than being on the school board is that our two organizations are really very closely intertwined and very symbiotic in a lot of the things that we do. And if we're going to be able to continue doing those things that we do for the district, then it's going to be really important that we can address our fiscal concerns and work something out that allows us to do the things we want to be doing. We have a short presentation for you tonight that's going to give you kind of the history of why we are where we are and our thoughts of what we want to do to try to remedy the problem. Bill Statler is going to lead off on that. One of the things that I want to point out is that we'll be talking about things that we do basically with schools within the city limits of the city of San Luis Obispo. But this is a problem that is not unique to only our city. All of the cities in the county are considering putting some sort of a ballot initiative on in the fall of 2006. And so City of Morro Bay, for example, where I live now, will probably be doing the same kind of thing. And hopefully if you have things that you do with the City of Morro Bay, they'll be able to continue to do those if they can address their woes. So with no further ado, really, I'm going to turn things over to Bill, and then Chief Linden and I will step back in at appropriate times.
Well, I want to thank you for this opportunity to share with you a little bit about the city's fiscal story, the challenges that are facing the city, what we're planning to do about that. We'll talk a little bit about how you have a stake in this outcome at the school district, and then be happy to answer any questions that you may have. As I think Wendy mentioned, the city of San Luis Obispo is not alone in the fiscal challenges. 100% of that total are enterprise operations like water, like sewer, parking, golf, transit. They're self-supporting with their own revenues, and it's that 60% piece of the pie, our general fund. That's where the challenge is that's facing us. Where does the revenue come from on that general fund slide? So a little over $40 million a year. Our single largest source of revenue is sales tax. About a third of our general fund operations are funded with that. In fact, it's almost twice as large as the next most important piece, and that's property taxes. In fact, our top five revenue sources, sales tax, property tax, transfer tax, utility users tax, and vehicle license fees, it's almost 75% of our total general fund budget.
What's your preference? Can we ask you questions as you
go? Sure, we can do this as we go along.
Are you getting, the city of SLO getting a slice of the county's overall property taxes, sort of like we do, or do you get a piece of your, within your own city limits property taxes?
Technically, we get a, 0.5% or 2% of the total countywide roll, just like you do. But relatively speaking, if you looked at the city in terms of our ABA transfer factor, we get about 14% of the property taxes from San Luis. But in fact, we are getting a slice of the entire countywide roll, just like you are. The difference is that that piece has been declining over time, as your piece has actually been increasing. Because what's been a loss to us, although it's zero sum for you, I mean, that's just been one of the ways that we've lost most of our property tax revenues, about $2 million a year, has been through property tax transfers, where $2 million of our tax revenues have been transferred to the schools. Now, that doesn't mean you have $2 million more. That just means the state of California has reduced its contribution for schools by a proportionate amount. But of that $3 million a year I mentioned that we lose to the state each and every year, about $2 million of that is a property tax shift that happened in the that happened in the late 90s, early 2000s. Key thing here is, again, sales tax revenue is our most important revenue source, almost a third of our total revenue stream. When you take a look at how those general fund revenues are used, 90% of our general fund revenues are just for day-to-day services, arresting bad guys, putting out fires, patching streets, mowing parks. About 5% is for our capital improvement program, and virtually all of that at this point is maintenance-oriented. I think the important thing to recognize about this slice is 3 years ago, capital improvements would have been 20% of this pie. But as we've had serious budget problems to reconcile, although we've made reductions in our operating programs as well, it's really been our capital improvement programs that have taken the biggest hit. Next slide. And when you look at those day-to-day operations, 50% of that is police and fire. Certainly that represents the fact that one of our fundamental responsibilities to the community is to provide public safety services. The reality is, as we've made cutbacks, yes, we've tried to not impact public safety, but you have to realize for every dollar you don't cut back in public safety means you got to cut back to someplace else. And what is that? That's parks and recreation programs, that's street maintenance, that's natural resource management, and our planning programs. 50% of our operating budget goes to public safety. Next slide. As we take a look at those are part of the new base. So even though 2 million may be a smaller number, it's after we've already brought to bear $7 million, well, in fact, $8.5 million worth of solutions leading into that. We successfully closed those gaps, and we largely did it through expenditure cuts. In fact, if you look at the last three budget seasons, about 70% of our total budget balancing solution has been on the expenditure side, 40% of that coming out of our capital improvement programs, 25% out of day-to-day operations. New revenues have played a role, and an important role, but certainly at 14%, not the leading one. And we've had to bring down our reserves, have been about 20% of that solution. Yeah.
Do you anticipate more reductions from the state takebacks within the next few years? One of the issues that we're dealing with, for instance, is Prop 76, and we know that that could permanently reduce our revenues throughout this for the schools. Does Prop 76 have that kind of negative impact on the cities as well?
I want to say no, but I'll tell you what, let me talk about that in the context of Proposition 1A, which I'm going to do in just a few minutes. So as you take a look at just this last year in 2005-07, how we made those reductions, every department participated in budget reductions, but they were not across the board. And our staff departments, like City Clerk, like Finance and Information Technology, they took the largest percentage reductions. Our frontline services, Public Works, Police and Fire, took the smallest reductions. Next slide. And as you look at staffing reductions, we have about 400 full-time equivalent employees. Over the last three budget seasons, we've reduced that by 25 positions. Again, every department participated in position reductions, but again, our staff departments, like finance and information technology, took the largest reductions. Frontline service, like police, took the smallest reductions. I think that's appropriate. It represented an attempt on our part to really take a look at priorities, avoid doing across-the-board cutbacks. The problem is, a department like finance and information technology, we can't sustain 14% reductions every year. And at some point, any further reductions are going to have to come out of those areas that have had the smaller reductions in the past. What are some of the impacts of those reductions? Well, first and foremost, we had to have that cut back in our sworn positions, including traffic enforcement, which is one of the key areas of concern that we know our community has. We don't have a full-time fire marshal. We don't have a full-time fire training officer. And in a community of 44,000 people with the importance of our fire programs, that's just really not acceptable. This third bullet's probably the most significant one. It's not the one you're going to see overnight, but we've cut back significantly in our paving, and one of the areas that's been hard to hit us the hardest is in our neighborhood paving program. Under our pavement management plan, our goal is to hit every neighborhood once every 8 years. In fact, the goal is to do every infrastructure improvement we need to do in that neighborhood, whether it's trees, whether it's sidewalks, whether it's water and sewer lines, and follow that up with a paving program, and to do that about every 8 years. We know from the pavement management plan we adopted back in 1998, we should be spending about $3 million a year in street paving. And now we're at the point where we're spending about $1 million a year. So we're underfunding that almost by two-thirds. Now, if I close a fire station tomorrow, you will notice the impact of that immediately.
We haven't been able to go ahead and repave them as they're supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a major problem for all cities. We've been really fortunate in 98. We adopted our pavement management plan. We were in pretty good financial shape in 1998, and we were spending that almost $3 million a year maintaining our streets that we're supposed to be doing. And we've been able to do that for 5 or 6 years, and we've seen significant improvements in the overall condition of our streets. But that's just, in our current fiscal situation, not something we're going to be able to sustain. We've also virtually no city funding for creek and flood protection. We've had to do cutbacks in our community development counter, probably a key area in a town like San Luis Obispo. We have one code enforcement officer to deal with all of the enforcement issues in the city. This is a major concern in many of our neighborhoods. This is just an area where we know we're underfunded, understaffed. And then lastly, we have a number of culture and social service organizations, about 50 in total, that receive funding from the city. They provide important services to our community, have a lot to do with making it the place to live that it is, but we've had to make cutbacks in those as well. Next slide. So let's talk a little bit about what the implications are for the San Luis Unified Coastal School District, and Deb Linden's going to talk about that.
Good evening. We wanted to just recap very briefly the police resources that are currently committed to schools within the city of San Luis Obispo, the San Luis Obispo Coastal Schools. We currently have two full-time school resource officers that are dedicated to the schools. One is dedicated full-time to the high school, and the second school resource officer splits the time between as the junior high school resource officer and our DARE officer, and we do provide DARE in all the elementary schools within the city. We're particularly proud of some of the outcomes from our school resource officer program in the high school. This past year, and working very closely with the high school principal, we together in partnership actually reduced the incidence of the possession of marijuana and under the influence of marijuana by 50% in 1 year, a 40% decrease in alcohol offenses, and a 25% increase in truancy. And really that was due to a combination of several things. First of all, closing the campus to the ninth graders, and that came from an analysis by our school resource officer and school staff on where the problems really were occurring. Second, really being proactive in ensuring that the campus remains drug-free. And third, a pretty healthy education component with our officer getting into the classrooms and talking to the kids in all the different grades.
Chief, I just want to interrupt you just for a second. Sure. And just mention that for the board members who have expulsion hearings, I think we all respect and appreciate the school resource officers very much because of the insights and input they provide to us during those difficult kinds of hearings. And I just wanted to mention that as you make your presentation.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The officer who does the junior high school and the DARE programs, we're really recognizing the need to interact much more frequently with the kids at a much younger age. By the time they're getting to high school with problems, it's too late, and we really needed to get to them at the elementary and the junior high school level. In addition to the school resource officer programs, there's a couple programs that the board may or may not be aware of. We do a program called 911 for Kids for officers in school zones, in one of the school zones, every morning when school is in session. So they do it randomly to do increased enforcement around the school zones in the morning. So we're out there a lot. One of the difficulties with these programs is I'm extremely committed to these services. I think it's incredibly important that we be involved in the children's lives from a very early age, from our youngest kids in first grade all the way through our resource officers in the high school. And I've had to make some very difficult recommendations to our city administrator about where the cut should occur within the police department. We've actually chosen to cut other frontline staff, patrol officers and traffic officers, before cutting these school resource officer positions, because I think it's just so important. I'm very, very committed to it. It's getting very, very difficult to do. These two positions specifically come up every year for very serious consideration for being reduced because of the budget challenges that Bill has described. But I think the outcomes are extremely positive. I look forward to working with the superintendent and looking for new ways that maybe we can partner in these programs and to keep them alive. I think they're very important at all levels. I'm not sure if our students see that at the high school or not, but I think the outcomes are very positive. That's sort of my portion of it. I'd be happy to entertain any questions before I sit down. Thank you.
Well, the part of this that I want to cover are really what we're calling cooperative use of facilities. But before I start, our Parks and Recreation Director told me that I had to say one thing, and that is that this hit the relationship between our city, or at least the Parks and Rec Department, and the school district is the best ongoing relationship around in his 40-plus years of career in Parks and Rec or in recreation. And he says the reason is that our kids are the focus of both parties, and he really wanted me to thank you for that. Basically, we have a number of cooperative uses of facilities, and this is where I really didn't realize this was going on when I was a board member. We have joint use of all of the athletic facilities at every elementary school in the city, at Laguna Middle School, the former junior high school, and the high school. And there's a joint use committee, which you probably know about, but they use about $20,000 worth of city funding every year for maintenance in some manner of those fields. And the point here is then the city can use those fields on the weekends and after hours, and the school district uses them during the school, and so it's a really nice partnership that works for everybody. In the past 10 years, about $250,000 has been put into field maintenance in this manner. And things that we've done with that money have been like put in baseball diamonds, things like that, that would not otherwise be there. They would just be a grass field. Another sharing is through park. This is actually district property, but the city put in the park and the city maintains it as a park. Then Pacheco School can use it during the day, and we use it as a park in off hours. We also paid about $75,000 per site to upgrade the elementary school gymnasiums, and this was an important thing. We can then use them for recreation programs for basketball, but they're also available then for the students on rainy days to be used for recreation within the school. And we did things like raising the roof and putting in the wood floors in the multipurpose rooms for that kind of thing. Sinsheimer Park is, again, a piece of school district students at all of the elementary schools in San Luis Obispo. And I remember when I was on the school board, one of the pressures that the city was starting to get as we were having more and more latchkey, I'm sorry, not the city, the school district was starting to get as we were having more and more latchkey kids was pressure to put after-school child care programs in. And I remember having a big philosophical discussion of, is this the appropriate thing for a school district to be doing? Well, you don't have to have that conversation because the city provides those programs in San Luis Obispo. And we have, so even though we do charge for them, we have a lot of scholarships for students that can't afford it, and the city absorbs about a third of the cost of that program, which is about $250,000 a year. We also run the middle school athletic program, except for the basketball program, and that means that, we are providing cross-country, track, and boys and girls volleyball programs there. So these are all the areas where we've worked very closely with the district, and we would like to be able to continue to maintain that level of partnership and service and maybe even look at more projects like the gymnasium projects, which we couldn't possibly do now. But given our circumstances, they kind of have to go into the hopper and be looked at, too.
Anyway, this was just really a high-level illustration of how we do work closely together at a staff operational level between the school district and the city, and that there are some strategic interests where we have a high-low of overlap. You know, question you might be asking yourselves is, so why is the city facing the fiscal problems that it is? It's no one reason, but there are several. The first and foremost, again, state of California takeaways, $3 million each and every year. Proposition 1A, which was overwhelmingly passed by the voters in November 2004, you know, it stops the bleeding. What Proposition 1A says is the state can't take more away from us than it is fairly and squarely taking away from us now. That's not an impermeable firewall. There are ways the state can take funds away from us, but it's a pretty high hurdle to cross. And so while Proposition 1A, really important, at least causing some stability, the stability that comes with it is it institutionalizes that $3 million a year in takeaways, and that's not going to come back. Directly, Proposition 76 shouldn't have the direct kind of consequence that it might have for a school district, for example, because in our case, it isn't the amount of money the state's giving us that we want them to keep giving us. It's the amount of revenue that's ours we don't want them to take anymore. And so it's a slightly different, well, fundamentally different, really, funding relationship than the school districts in the state have with the state. Technically, you know, our sales tax revenues are our sales tax revenues, and our piece of the property tax pie is theoretically our piece of the property tax pie. State can redo that, can change that, high hurdle under 1A to do it, but there isn't something that if there was a new fiscal problem and the governor decided that he needed to stop the bleeding, that there isn't some important source of revenue that they would cut off to the city, because it would simply, but what it would do is preclude them from being able to take more revenue away from us as part of that budget balance solution. But for the relief valves that are in Proposition 1A, it is allowed 405 essentially flat. Now, flat in the context of what happened to other communities is probably not so bad. On the Monterey Peninsula, they saw a 25% decrease in that revenue source after 9/11. But the reality is this is our number three revenue source, and it essentially has not grown for 3 years. We have increased service demands. We fully knew, well knew, that when we built the Damon Garcia sports fields, we would have to maintain and operate them. So it's not a new thing on the radar. It simply means there's a difference between when you know a facility is going to come online and it's going to cost you $300,000 a year to maintain, and when it does actually come online and cost you $300,000 a year to maintain. Need to update critical. Mardi Gras costs. This last year we spent $350,000 dealing with Mardi Gras. Our hope is certainly that we can ratchet that down over time, but it's still about a $300,000 item in our current budget, and that's going to be with us for some time to come. PERS investment losses, in terms of the impact that's had on our retirement rates, that's sort of the perfect storm between 9/11. The dot-com blow-up and corporate thievery, WorldCom, Enron, Anderson had significant effects on the stock market. That had significant impacts on PERS portfolio, and that in turn has had impacts on the city's retirement rates. higher costs in any number of key areas. I'm sure the school district has seen the same thing. Utilities cost more, fuel costs more, and because a lot of our work is paving related, that's directly related to petrochemicals, and we're seeing significant increased costs in the construction area, especially as it relates to paving materials. And then lastly, there's just reduced grant revenues all around. The city, along with the county, is a supporter of the Prado Daycare Center for homeless folks. At one time, that was a grant-funded program. Now we're spending $50,000 each and every year to do that. Next slide. So while we continue to have these funding gaps, our community has told us that they want consistent and expanded services, and we want to provide it. You know, there's a conventional wisdom out there that says that people want less government. Well, that may be true in other places. It's certainly not true in San Luis Obispo through any number of vehicles, whether it's our community budget bulletin, whether it's through professional public opinion research, whether it's through community forums. When we ask people in any range of areas, do you want the same level of service, do you want less service or more, overwhelmingly our community wants the same level of service or more. And although we have, I think, very responsively balanced our budget, in the short term, it's irresponsible for us to continue to draw down on reserves, cut back on community services, and significantly underfund important infrastructure maintenance like street repair. So we've had no choice but to seriously consider a revenue ballot measure in November 2006. But I think that's the important thing. We haven't made any decision to do that yet. That's still way over a year away. But we need to start preparing for that now, and we're in the process of gathering information and more feedback from the community before we go further. Why is this critical for us? Take a look at something like paramedic calls for service, fire calls for service. Those are up by 65% through to the bottom of the storm drain. Next slide. The state, again, can't overemphasize enough the impact that state takeaways have had on the city. One of the advantages, if we have a local measure, this would give ourselves local control over local resources to keep those dollars here for essential services. And then lastly, budget cuts have forced us to cut back on our infrastructure maintenance by 50%. Without additional funds, we're just not going to be able to maintain the city's infrastructure, and it's going to continue to deteriorate. Talk a little bit about fiscal accountability. Any plan that we present to our voters are going to include strong fiscal accountability measures. Citizens' oversight and review of any funding generated by a revenue measure, full and ongoing disclosure of how we spend the funds, and a sunset provision. At this point, our plan is to present to the voters a general purpose revenue measure that would require majority voter approval, because the reality is our problem isn't we need a new fire station, we need a new police station, we need to widen a bridge, we need to build a new road. Our problem is the ability to arrest bad guys, put out fires, pave the streets, and mow the parks. We need added revenues just to do day-to-day essential delivery of services. So we're going to be asking the public, in essence, to trust the council that they'll spend that money wisely. We think we have a high level of trust in the community. On the other hand, I think we need to provide verification and proof of that commitment. So probably any measure that we submit will probably have a 5 or 10 year sunset measure, which will basically be saying, have confidence that we're going to spend the money wisely, but if 5 years from now you don't think we've spent it on the most important things for us to spend it on, then don't re-up on it. Sunset provision isn't going to be because the problems go away. Sunset provision is going to be for us to demonstrate that we've used the money wisely. A little bit about the community's funding priorities. What are the most important things for us to spend the money on? Our public has told us to date that repairing and maintaining city streets, mitigating traffic congestion, improving levels of public safety, and protecting senior services, these are the things that our public has told us are the most important things, and these are the things that we should be judged on 5 or 10 years from now. Have we used any added funds to take care of our streets, to improve public safety, protect senior services, and improve traffic congestion? Our initial thoughts, we're still early in the planning process. We haven't made any commitments. But our initial concept at this point would be an increase in the city's sales tax rate of no more than a half a cent. The level of increase is still under review, but I think it's important to realize that the city's sales tax rate is the lowest rate in the state of California. In fact, even if we move that sales tax by a half a cent, it would still be lower or equal to that rate paid by 85% of the state's residents. So if we were to do a quarter cent, half a cent sales tax rate, we would still be in the mainstream of other communities in California. Sales tax is very broad-based, and in our case, about half of that's going to be paid by other people and not people that live in the city of San Luis Obispo. And sales tax measures are increasingly being used by other cities throughout the state. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions. One of the things that
I have the most trust in democracy at the local level. I was listening to Democracy Now! Last Friday, and I don't know what you know about telecommunications companies pay franchise fees to local municipalities, how much money San Luis Obispo takes in from cable companies and companies that build their infrastructure, you know, their lines and all through the city. Apparently, the city gets some revenue from those companies. But there's a bill before the Senate and apparently some in the House called the Broadband Investment and Consumer Choice Act, which was introduced in July by Republican Senators John Ensign of Nevada and John McCain of Arizona. And according to the bill, the act would eliminate government-managed competition of existing communication service, that's in quotes, and provide parity between functionally equivalent services, end quote. But it says here, essentially the legislation would eliminate a requirement for telecommunications companies to pay franchise fees to local municipalities. And these fees are required as compensation to the community for use of the public right-of-way through which the companies route cables and utilities. By eliminating the franchise fees, the bill will eliminate the only source of funding that the public access provider receives. The bills would replace local cable franchises with national franchises, and the concern is that this will take control and oversight away from local government, as well as cut channel capacity for public, educational, and governmental access channels, or PEGs. And I know that's another cooperation between city and the school district, is the public television. We haven't really got into using that yet, but I understand that we're, you know, cooperating with the city on that, and there's a lot of potential for wonderful things happening there. So I'm just saying this, I don't know what the resources are, but I think there's even more threats than from the state, from the federal level, and we might want to be proactive in writing senators and representatives to maintain that source of revenue for cities.
Yeah, the city is very concerned about what's happening with telecommunications, and you know, a lot of the lines are getting blurred between what a telecommunication provider is, between traditional telecommunication providers like SBC versus the cable industry, and with wireless services on the advance. But as you pointed out, there are significant impacts to a community in terms of impacts on infrastructure from telecommunication providers. The city's opposed efforts to further reduce local control. I would point out the argument that the telecommunication providers will point out is we can't have 470 different rules in California, 19,000 local governments throughout the state. And, you know, if they'll agree to have in place a franchise fee that is the highest in the nation, and they want to adopt that nationwide in the interest of consistency, I'll be willing to give up local control. But let's be honest, the issue is not consistency. The issue is greed. So, you know, it's very problematic for the city. The revenues we get from the telecommunications industry are an important part of our revenue base. And from my perspective, now just doesn't seem to be the time to be providing tax breaks.
I'm wanting to use it too, and so that is something that would be lost. But yeah, we're on top of that one and tracking it very closely.
Thank you. Mr. Millar.
I just wanted to acknowledge a couple of things in your presentation. This sounds, first of all, I'm really glad we're a school district. This sounds very familiar to us. We consider a parcel tax, and I kind of understand what what you're dealing with. I have two sons who are graduates of Sun and Fun, sometimes referred to as Rain and Pain, by the clients, and I've lived adjacent to C.L. Smith and now live adjacent to Laguna Middle School, and the joint use facilities, the city programs in our schools, the cooperation has just been remarkable. When I first lived across from C.L. Smith, you couldn't really tell where the city park kind of thing started and the school grounds started. Kids, where it was a magnet for the kids and community activities, is just great. I'd hate to see it. If you get to the stage where you're going to proceed with the tax, I would be happy to do whatever I can to make sure the citizens understand what a wonderful contribution the city makes to our schools and that we work to preserve that, and I appreciate the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comment? Okay, well, thank you very much for coming and sharing with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And Wendy, our capable assistant, maybe supported by the police chief, will be gathering up those surveys if you have them completed. Again, thank you very much for an opportunity to come tell our story. I should tell you that it is our plan to engage in the next 9 months in a very intensive community outreach program to talk to every community-based group in town to get our story out. And in the final analysis, you know, to let the voters decide and make that trade-off between the services they want, the cost of those services. But we're going to try and do our very best job of engaging the community over the next 9 months in that dialogue. So, again, thank you very much for being part of that.
Excellent. Thank you. Moving on to correspondence. There was none received that the board is aware of. The next item is public comment. Have we received any requests to address the board?
Marlene Mendez.
Good evening. My name is Marlene Mendez, and I have taught physical education for a total of 28 consecutive years, 21 of those being in San Luis Obispo High School. I have a capable to demonstrate advanced knowledge and skills in two or more individual and dual activities in one or more of the following categories. In the dual activities listed, number one is the game of badminton. This is what I'm trying to teach my students. I'm prevented from teaching this, and my students are prevented from learning this because the badminton lines were not replaced on the newly refurbished gym floor. Since the day I first entered San Luis Obispo High School, badminton lines have historically been painted on the gym floor along with the volleyball and basketball lines. Trying to teach badminton to teenagers without lines is impossible. I have 41 students, and at times I have had up to 52 students per class. Therefore, at present, I need at least 10 courts with lines on them in order to meet the state standards of individual and dual activities. There is room in our gym for 12 badminton courts, which allows for the most students possible to be active, to participate, and to learn. Prior to the refurbishment of the gym floor, I made my concerns known to my department chair, Vic Eklund, my principal, Will Jones. Since the decision was made not to repaint the badminton lines on the floor, I have spoken with my department chair, my principal, and the district superintendent, Ed Valentine, about getting badminton lines on the court. At this point, 1 week and 2 days into our three-week badminton unit, the students still do not have the lines by which to learn the game. I have researched and found that painter's tape will not harm the varnish on the floor. Experienced painters have said that the varnish is, if it's put on correctly, the painter's tape will not harm the floor. Mr. Jones has determined that the painter's tape does take the varnish off the $40,000 refurbished floor. Laguna Middle School, Los Osos Middle School, and Morro Bay High School all have painted badminton lines on their gym floor, just like the volleyball and basketball lines. Perhaps the varnish on the San Luis High gym floor was not applied correctly. If that is the case, I propose the gym floor be refurbished correctly with badminton lines painted on before the guarantee is up. Meanwhile, Mr. Jones is exploring the possibility of wallpaper tape. I need to stop. And this is dragging on and on. I'm afraid the unit will be over before my students have the lines with which to learn the game. So, Board, my hands are tied. I want to teach the state-mandated standards, and I want my students to be active 100% of the time, especially because we have the space to make this possible. Additionally, I want them to learn the game of badminton in accordance with the state standards. I have explored every avenue concerning this problem open to me in the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. That is why I'm now bringing this issue before you. I need direction as to how this problem can be solved for the benefit of our 236 physical education students with which this matter impacts this year. Thank you for your consideration in this matter. And I've also attached badminton fitness results back here as to the number, as to the percentage of how fit students can become by playing badminton. And then I've also attached a court so it shows you all the different lines that we really need to be able to play the game. So if you have any questions.
Yeah. Madam Chair, yes, I have a question. We can't, Marlene, you know we can't really get into a discussion about this at this time, but I do have a question. I haven't played badminton since high school, and it was on the regular court, the basketball court. What is a significant difference in playing badminton where there are no lines? Is that, I can't remember
yes.
high school.
Yes. Yeah, you can't play
no
badminton.
Comments.
Sorry. You need badminton lines rather than basketball lines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. We can't engage in discussion about it, but we have heard you, and we thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Is there anyone who did not submit a request but who would like to address the board? Okay. Seeing no one, then we'll move on. Reports by school staff and student representatives. Staff reports. Okay, then we have Chaney Butcher. Is that, I can never say your name right now.
Chaney.
Yeah,
it's close. That's okay. I'm used to it. Thanks. All right, I'm just going to let you guys know what's going on in October at San Luis Obispo High School. First up, tomorrow night is a University of California application night at 7 o'clock in the cafeteria. On the 7th, our football team will be playing San Benito. It's a home game. It's at 7:30, so you guys should all come and support. On the 8th, we have SAT 1 and 2s at Cuesta. And also on Saturday, our band and color guard will be competing in a field show competition at Paso High School. On the 13th at 7 o'clock is a California State University application night in the cafeteria. On the 15th, we will have PSATs at 8 o'clock in the morning in the cafeteria. On the 21st, our choir will be at Westmont College for a choir festival, so I'm sure they'll do really good at that. Also really important this month is homecoming. We have a lot of activities with that. It's the week of the 24th through the 29th. On Monday is our skit. It's a really cool performance. You guys should all come. On the 25th, Tuesday, is Powder Puff. We have games at 5 and 6. That's always really fun. Wednesday is Breakfast Club at 7 o'clock in the cafeteria. On the 28th, we have a parade at 3:15 downtown, and it's really cool just to see all the parades, all the different floats and stuff. And then the game is at 7:30 versus Paso, so we're hoping to do good in that too. And then on the 29th is the dance. So that's what's going on at San Luis.
Thank you. Thank you. Then we have the team of Lindsay Ayotte and Sage Stein from Morro Bay High School.
Yes. My name is Lindsay Ayotte, and tonight I decided to bring Sage Stein, and we're going to be working hand-in-hand to switch off going to school board meetings since we have to commute the farthest, since we live in Morro Bay. Most of them are in St. Louis. But tonight I just wanted to let you know that we are very proud of our 817 score on our California Contents test. And administration last year, they shaved their heads and they decided to do something less drastic. So they're going to send each class on a separate weekend from November, December, January, and February to Disneyland. And they worked out a deal where it's going to be $60 per student. And that also, I have fair results. I didn't get to tell you guys last month, but I'm sure you're excited to hear about this. In steer competition, we had Cody Keller. He received reserve champion for black steer, and Darren Molnar placed third for steer. For lambs, Leanne Michelle placed fourth, Emily Vickers placed seventh, Katrina Mays placed sixth, Elisa Sharp placed fifth, Kayla Ruiz placed third, Megan Ryan placed sixth, Don Williams placed first, Notori Coleman placed seventh, and Candace Klein placed third. And for pigs, Ryan Cummings received reserve champion for the York breed. Kevin McCool received champion in all other breeds. Brandon Colombo got first place for crossbreed. H.T. Waterworth placed third in class for the York. And Brandon Colombo received fourth place overall for fair and showmanship. And we had our ROP landscape, who took second overall in the whole fair. So they were really excited about their accomplishments this summer. This past Saturday at Morro Bay, the FFA hosted the annual opening and closing contest, where teams from all over the region come to compete on novice, advanced, and officer team levels, and our officer team took third. So overall, it was a great success, according to the FFA. Club Rush was September 22nd. It went well. ASB had a barbecue. We sold hot dogs, and there was a lot of involvement from the school. And Peer Helping came out in the middle of the quad, and they had a trash can, and they're trying to raise money for the Hurricane Katrina Relief Fund. And their goal is to raise $2,500, which they met, and they donated that to Red Cross. And now they're working hand-in-hand with Giovanni, who owns Giovanni's Italian Restaurant in the Embarcadero, on a campaign called Morro Bay Cares. And it's a citywide relief effort to raise money from the 600 businesses in Morro Bay to get them to pledge 5% of their proceeds on October 12th to go towards the Salvation Army. That's Morro Bay Cares. It's a citywide effort, and the pledge is October 12th, and their goal is to have all 600 businesses in Morro Bay. So that's an average of 30 businesses per student that they have to go out and collect pledges from. So they're really looking forward to that. We'll keep you up on the update. October 5th is our grad night committee meeting. They're planning the senior grad night, and they're always looking for support. So parents, if you're interested, you can contact them at Morro Bay High School. October 6th is the college night at our school. It's in the Science Lecture Demo Hall. It's put on by the counselors, and it is going to parents and students to go over requirements for college and answer questions and so on and so forth. The 8th is our Boosters Annual Golf Tournament in Avila. 7 a.m., they're serving breakfast and tee off shortly after. It's to support football and water sports for the coming year. The 10th, we have our countywide college night at Cuesta Gym from 6 to 8. It's open to all students. We encourage you to bring your family. There's 60 to 70 college representatives from CSU, UCs, and private universities. They'll be there to answer questions about financial aid information and athletic eligibility. And that is October 10th. It's the countywide college night at Cuesta Gym from 6 to 8. And that's located at the back of the university, in case anyone didn't know where that is. The 15th, the Aggie Backers are putting on a barn dance. It's to raise money for the FFA. You have to be over 21 to go, and I'm sure they're going to have fun raffles. And there is prizes for the winner of the performance. Tuesday, we have our carnival at lunch and at night. It's from 6 to 9. You guys are more welcome to come out and participate in some fun games. Movie night is Tuesday. It's at 7 o'clock in the old gym. We'll be showing The Labyrinth, featuring David Bowie this year. Thursday is our bonfire, And our lunchtime activity is Where's Waldo? We're going to have kind of like a scavenger hunt where students have to find Waldo on campus, and there will be many clues and so on and so forth. So it will be fun for the freshmen who are stuck on campus. And maybe we can get older classmen to stay on campus as well. Friday, we have our homecoming assembly and our game at 7:30. It's versus Cabrillo at the school. So we more than welcome you guys to come out and see that. We'll have our pregame and our halftime show. And the 22nd is our homecoming dance. It's 8 to 11 in the old gym. Last year, we didn't have a homecoming dance due to the budget and the lack of effort shown by the student body to come out and participate. But this year, we've made it a semi-formal, and we have a DJ coming down from San Jose that's a company known as Feet First, and it's $6 with ASB card and $8 without, so it's really affordable, and we just kind of want to bring back the old school spirit for homecoming. And homecoming nominations are underway as we speak this week. Let's see, the 28th is the end of the first quarter, and the 29th is our is a spaghetti dinner put on by the baseball team. It's in the cafeteria, and tickets are still available for support. And you can contact Coach Greer for more information at extension 2928. And following homecoming week is National Red Ribbon Week, and we as ASB have decided to promote it. It's an anti-drug awareness program where we just come out to the students and let them know all the stuff that Red Ribbon Week has to offer, that we're going to have lunchtime activities, and we're still working on having a motivational speaker come and speak to the students. But other than that, all fall sports are underway, and everyone is still really excited about our win against St. Joe. And this Friday, we play Longpoke in Longpoke at 7:30. So if you guys are willing to make that long drive, we would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank
Mrs. Roger,
you.
Can I ask Lindsay a question?
Yes, sir.
May I? It's a straight
yeah,
question.
Yeah, that's fine.
You mentioned one of the restaurants in Morro Bay that was sponsoring...
Yeah, Giovanni's.
Is that Giovanni's or Giancarlo's?
It's Giovanni's.
Giovanni's, okay.
I'm pretty sure it's Giovanni's.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Okay, well, Lindsay, I think you've probably frightened Sage half to death. Sage, you should realize that the report is not usually that lengthy. And we really appreciate all of you joining us. As always, you're welcome to stay and enjoy the meeting or go home and do homework, or as my grandmother used to say, maybe you just want to pop popcorn and jive. So, thank you for coming. Okay, let's see. Status of the state budget, Mr. Miller.
Thank you. The presentation by the city brings to mind some of our past. It allowed the suspension of Prop 98 in order to participate in helping to solve the budget crisis that the state of California had created. In that outcome of our participation and the suspension of Prop 98, the governor exceeded his promises and actually reneged on one, which was to restore and not take more than $2 billion from the education community. One of the things the city needs to remember is always to protect its own, because once you give it up, then the ability of the state to continue to take from you is probably something you're not going to be able to fight against. And as we see, the special election, Prop 76, that's coming up, is another attempt by the state to water down Prop 98 and make it easier for them to suspend Prop 98. The good news on this, the piece I want to finish with, is that all of the local polls, the statewide polls, reflect that the propositions proposed for the special election in November are at rock-bottom support, as is the governor's popularity. It has never been lower. No governor has ever had the numbers that this governor doesn't enjoy, and we can only reflect that education is still the number one issue for voters in the state of California. So we look forward to the election in November and the outcome of solidifying our Prop 98 and helping to prevent any more raids against it.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Yes, Mr. Miller.
Are his numbers lower than Gray Davis's numbers? Wow.
the next item
Maybe Mike McCarthy should have won the governorship.
Item 3, PEAs. It's an action discussion item, grades 4 through 6. Dr. Valentine? Or Dr. Matakovich, I beg your pardon.
That's fine. Good evening. Elementary physical education teachers have been responsible for teaching physical education curriculum in the district for many years. Beginning in 92-93, classes in elementary PE were routinely doubled up where scheduling allowed, and PE specialists would teach two classes of students simultaneously. The district hired elementary PE aides who assisted PE specialists in these classes. The aide's job description includes helping maintain records, supervising students, assisting in instructional activities, demonstrations, and assessments, and helping with setup, equipment, and inventory. During the 01 budget cuts, it was decided to keep the PE specialists in fourth through sixth grade program, and have the first through third grade program be the responsibility of the regular classroom teacher. With the elimination of the elementary PEA position in 01, the safety and supervision of students was raised as a concern. During the time the position was eliminated, there have been 11 injuries that have been reported in the elementary PE program. Currently, there are 52 upper grade classes in the district. These classes are doubled up wherever possible. The average class size is 58 students. In these classes,
elementary school PE teachers out here who I know work very, very hard. I would refer the board to a couple of incidents that I know that I have certainly read about and heard about. One was students stepping on, I believe, a beehive at Sensheimer School, at Los Ranchos School during PE, and the PE teacher having to manage 58 students or whatever the number of students were, plus manage a swarm of bees after students, and I can't think that that's good for kids. Other things that I've heard about anecdotally are students acting out severely during PE classes. If the PE teacher has to take care of one student, that leaves the rest of the students up to 59 students, let's say, unsupervised. And if a student really is having significant problems, then who's going to take the student to the office and take care of them? I have some other issues from my own experience, and certainly not in our district, but I do know that there are health and safety concerns. One of the teachers for the County Office of Education, probably about 12 years ago, was sadly the witness to a student who had probably an aortic aneurysm or something along those lines during recess at one of the schools in Atascadero, and the teacher of the County Office of Education wound up having to give the student CPR. And I would hate to think that although our teachers are well-trained, something like that could happen, and I think that we can recognize the safety issues for students. If a PE teacher was alone with a group of students and somebody did have a significant medical problem, I'd be very concerned about not only that student, the support that student would receive, but also minding the rest of the students. So I would absolutely support this. I think $26,000 to $37,000 is cheap, and I think it's something that is long overdue.
Mrs. Botwin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I certainly support what Chris just said totally. Along with that, I was reading the Friday packet, and we talked about our potential goals that we revised for the board retreat. The first one is student achievement and well-being, and in there it says to provide for each student a safe school, to know who the student is, to care about the student, clarify what's important for that student to know and do, to refine instructional practices, maintain accountability for that student's achievement and well-being, which is very much what Chris was just talking about, and I feel very strongly about too, and develop in the student a sense of personal responsibility and advocacy for his or her education. And I think it pretty much sums it up. Absolutely. We should do whatever's necessary here to get PE aids back in place, to not only for protection. And I think our PE people have done a marvelous job of maintaining the testing quality these last couple of years since the program was cut. But when you think of testing 58 to 60 students, and it's either one-on-one or small groups, what's going on out there with all? Think of it as a nightmare. Anyhow, I recommend that we go ahead and support this add back up.
And as Chris pointed out, the dollar amount is affordable if that's the direction the board wishes to go.
For my part, maybe Mr. Robinette could speak to, I too support the return of PE aids. And I'm glad that we will be able to do it, but I'm wondering about the logistics of it. Finding people who are able to, could you speak to that just a little bit?
I think it's like any other recruitment. We'll go out and see what we can do. I think that it's very likely we can staff physical education aides. One of the difficulties we had before the cuts were the fact that we had doubled up classes where PE aides would serve for a half hour period of time, might go into a lunch period, than a class where maybe there wasn't a doubled up class for no need for a PE aid. And so we'd have these blocks of half hour here, hour there, and those are difficult to staff. The higher figure you were given, the approximately 37,000 figure, was for a model more like what Lucia Marr is doing, actually providing an instructional aid that travels with the PE teacher and is not just kind of assigned piecemeal throughout the district. That probably would be an easier position to recruit to, because it'd be essentially a 5.5-6 hour
it would be
aid
an itinerant
position
itinerant
that would
aid.
That would probably travel with the PE specialist. But however we do it, we're usually able to fill and staff the positions that we're given to staff.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Well, this is action discussion. Does anybody want to move action?
See it just as
it's simply discussion at this time. So our direction to staff, Mr.
Moore. I think we're all excited about that idea. What about you, Glenn?
Bring it back as an action item, I guess.
Okay, Mr. Millar is telling me that I'm the president, so I should provide direction to make it happen.
We can do that. I think part of the discussion that the board had regarded budget item changes, and that it might be cleaner since we've gone beyond level 3 and we have no series of additional recommendations, that we do bring it back to you. We certainly have your sense, and we'll be moving down the road, but next board meeting we'll bring you an action item.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, item 4 is a discussion of the mission statement. Dr. Valentine.
Thank you. The board has been entertaining discussions of the entire strategic planning process, and the headline, I guess, of that process is the district mission statement. In the backup tonight, we've provided the board with some history of the district's mission statement. It was developed through a lengthy participatory community process in 1992-93, and it was additionally reaffirmed in 1998. The mission statement itself is provided to the board tonight. The kind of values that we're seeing in this is an affirmation of providing students who are unable to make...
I rushed off to school and was busy every single second and came home and haven't had a chance to read that yet.
Well, tomorrow. It's the very point that you made about the mission statement. His point is that as we live longer, the period of dependency of the older people is longer, and by making our world more technologically complex, children are dependent on their families longer. So at both ends of our lives, there are periods of greater dependency, and those in the middle, the sandwich generation they call us, are going to connect with those other generations, and it's sort of a mitigating factor to our character, which stresses independence. And you could have written the editorial. So I think it's good that we are talking about this. I also brought it up again with my daughter. She's always my BS detector. And for her, the value of self-reliance and independence is very strong. So I think in dealing with kids, we are dealing with people at that age. We're trying to stress that. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to lose that.
No,
but I think also the values that you pointed out are really very important and becoming more important in our society.
We should give proper credit. That was David Brooks who wrote there.
Oh, was it David Brooks? I thought it was Krugman. Thank you, Dr. Olker.
Mrs. Dickinson.
It almost seems like a formality to talk about a mission statement. It's such a wonderful district because we hire great people and we have faith in teachers and their judgment and their scope. So I think there's a sense of it's all going really well and we know what we're doing and we're on top of things and we're responsive. So, you know, it's sort of a like a stickiness spoke in the a stick in the spoke to stop and talk about the mission statement. I sense there's a little frustration with the, you know, taking time to do something like that. But I think it's, you know, when we invest so much in personnel and in programs and facilities, you know, there's so much invested in education, it is appropriate after 12 years or whatever to stop and say, you know, what are we doing? What's our mission? What's important? Has anything changed? You know, is this what we still want to say? And actually, is it translating out into actual lesson plans and conversations in the school? You know, is it a vibrant kind of a generating mechanism in our whole school system? So I think it's a very appropriate conversation. Things keep happening. The hurricane came up, and there was a article in the Tribune on Sunday, disasters portend a more dangerous future. Just one quick paragraph in there, and it's not just coastal populations that are at risk. Infrastructure supplies food, energy, and materials nationwide, like the body's circulatory system, distributes blood and nutrients. If the New Madrid Fault ruptures in the Midwest, the loss of key roads, railways, power grids, and pipelines over the Mississippi River would likely choke off vital supplies to distant cities for months, including Washington, D.C. And just a little story from class. I mean, Chris talked about county, but Arroyo Grande High School special education, one of our vocabulary words was fast, meaning, you know, refrain from eating. So I told the kids, you know, Ramadan is here, and told them all about it, and how the Muslims do not eat from sun up to sunset. And we talked about how that's different in summer than winter. And they were pretty amazed about that. Of course, they can eat, you know, when the sun goes down. But the kids were all saying, you know, why would they want to do that for a month? So I told them that from I've learned from my friends is they want to keep in touch, you know, with what it's like to be hungry and the people in the world who are in need and, you know, kind of understand poverty. And I said that even though I am not a Muslim, I do admire that part of their religion. So one of my kids says, why do they want to, you know, bomb them, blow themselves up? So we started talking about fringe groups, and it was a big discussion. The rest of the period was kind of on this. But even at the end of that, he said, well, why don't we just bomb them all? So then we started talking about radiation washing around the planet, and we are at risk when our environment is jeopardized in that way with increased radiation. And he didn't know that. He thought radiation cured cancer instead of causing it. But there's so much kids are interested in and they don't know about and how we all relate. And I think that having something in a mission statement does translate out in spontaneous conversations and in planned lessons. I think it's important for us to think about changing that. I have had conversations with friends and family, and some of you out here got emails from me about this. And my brother, Craig, who's an intellectual and poet, who actually lives in Eugene, but he submitted one that I think is interesting. I do want to read. Educate for self-reliance and concern for others. Educate for citizenship in our country and participation in our diverse world. Educate to the highest standards, taking full account of each child's talents and abilities and each child's right to a place in life's adventure. I like that one. But I think our board may do the conservative thing of changing a word here and there, I'm guessing. But I think it's okay to be bold in thinking and stretch out a little bit. So I'm eager to hear what everyone else thinks. One other thought, I just want to say one last thing. When we got a new board member, even though that's usually voted on by everyone, we picked one, six of us, I guess. And then we had this opportunity for the community to, some kind of mechanism where they could respond or put their input in a certain amount of time. I think the board could change something in the statement and have a little time like that where if the community really didn't like it or wanted to respond, they could, in a very similar kind of strategy for community accountability or whatever.
Mrs. Andreen.
And I feel that it would be inappropriate for us to do anything at a board meeting that would make fundamental changes to the mission statement.
Mrs. Botwin.
I'm thinking. Go to somebody else, please.
Okay. I guess we're not considering having a time of community input, because I think that would be fine, too. But apparently we don't want to spend that time. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, if I can just finish up. Last time we talked about it being kind of out of sync with our strategic planning. It's at an awkward time in terms of where we're going with our planning for the year. And I think there would be a better time to do this, and I still think it's good that we're talking about it now.
I think it's something that could be held in abeyance. We have given staff very clear direction on what the focus or the various focuses that we want them to pursue for us. And at this point in time, to ask them to add something new, to organize community meetings and what have you, it takes away from things that we've already prioritized, so we need to be careful what messages we give to them.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mrs. Botwin.
I'm sorry, you were looking the other way.
Thank you.
I like all your ideas, Adrienne, I particularly like yours. I love the one that was written here. I love that. Craig did a beautiful job. Educate for self-reliance, concern for others. Whoa, that was very moving. And I had, being an English teacher, a retired English teacher, I had honed down ours to about half the length, and I thought it was brilliantly done. So what do I know? I do like the other ideas, Patty's and Marilyn's both, that maybe we should set a timeline for this. When we get back, and I thought that our summer workshop was good and gave us time to do different things, and I would like to spend more time on creative things like this than the other typical kind of board meeting information. And maybe if we got a message out to the two ASBs, the high school, Patty, might that be something where we might ask the ASB if they would be interested in coming up with a proposal that they would like to see a mission statement? We get that from them. We ask anybody else in the public through the board meetings, over the television or any other way, to get more input. You keep digging up these gorgeous things, and we'll look at it and put it together maybe during one of our summer workshops. Is that a possibility? How do you guys feel about that?
I wouldn't think that we could say just now tonight when it'll be perfect to do it, but I think it has a lot to do with the cycle of the strategic planning, and you know, we're just setting up our goals and our process for this year. I think there would be a time, you know, sort of that would feel right when we get to the end of this cycle when we could do that, but put it off and think about it this summer would be my take on it.
Mrs. Dickinson.
You know, we have had it on the agenda, and people have known about it for a month, let's say, and I don't think that, you know, people are just jumping up and down to rewrite it. So my sense is that just what I started with, that the district seems to be doing well, and we have fine teachers and educators and all. So I think your idea of just being alert and aware and sensitive to when it might be a good time. I still think the one word should be changed, and I think that it would be in our purview to change self-sufficient to self-reliant, which we talked about. So I would, is this an action thing? No. I am interested in what you all think about at least changing that adjective.
I don't know whose microphone was down first, Mr. Unger or Dr. Valentine, but Dr. Valentine's waving to me.
I'll be brief. I shared with the board in a Friday update that what I would like to do is bring back to the board as soon as possible next meeting, if we get clear direction on this one, both the mission statement and the district goals for affirmation from the board. We've drafted and we've talked and we've retreated, and I think we're at a point where we have some verbiage that we can present to you to say, shall we move forward with this or not? And we would base the strategic planning process around those. I don't think that at whatever point, if we should revisit the mission statement, I don't think it will trip up our strategic plan in a huge way, because when we talk about students being self-sufficient and being able to make contributions to society, my reaction to that mission plan, and I wasn't part of the drafting of it, but my reaction to it is that was a conscious attempt. It hits me that way. It was a conscious attempt to communicate both the notion of self-reliance and self-sufficiency and the notion of interdependency and connectedness. And I think that if we were to change the wording at some later point in time, we wouldn't discover that we'd gone down the wrong path with the current mission statement.
Okay, Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I guess I've given this some thought myself, and I'm not opposed to looking at the mission statement in the context of the things we've been talking about. One thing that I keep going back to is Mrs. Botwin's comment that this mission statement took 6 months to develop, and I'm seeing head shakes out there. And I'm really not willing to tinker. Although I, as I've thought and sort of percolated through this, I'm not in opposition to self-reliant. I kind of like self-sufficient. I'm a mountain man, you know. I go up to the North County every day. But I think self-reliant has benefit as well. But I don't want to start picking this apart. And one of the reasons is that I'm concerned that it would... There was a committee of people that worked really hard on this thing, and I want to honor their work. I think if we're going to look at this, I think it would demonstrate good faith in our compact with the community to throw this open to the community and to have community impact, to have community input on this.
Bring it back as is unless directed otherwise, along with the draft goals that we have gone through at the next meeting for an action on both of those.
Mrs. Dickinson.
I thought there were several of us that thought at least changing one, that phrase would be good,
but
am I wrong? I thought there were at least four. I'm not sure.
I'm just seeking clarification on that.
Okay, so we have Mrs. Botwin in favor of the change to self-reliant, Mrs. Dickinson.
And Chris mentioned that, too.
No.
You did it?
No.
Oh, the mountain man.
I like the notion of it, but I'm not willing to tinker with the current mission statement
at all.
At all.
Okay.
I feel like I want to, if we're going to do it, let's just do it, and let's look at how we want to have the thing done. But I don't, I'm very reluctant to start picking it apart word for word. And, you know, one of the concerns I have is that if a different board comes on here, starting to pick apart the mission statement without community input could have some pretty devastating effects to the district. So I would rather keep precedent as we've done in the past.
Is there any additional support for changing from self-sufficient to self-reliant?
Well,
Mrs. Andreen,
I just want to say that I had at one point thought it wouldn't make any difference, but I started to think about it after listening to Mr. Unger, and, you know, if we change one word, and then I never really liked the word guarantee, and we start doing that, and then while we get going, somebody else says, well, you know, I really don't think we've got it quite right where we're talking about potential. We're picking it away. Maybe we're doing more than just changing one word. So I think maybe the most honest thing to do is to just say this discussion has given us all good things to think about, and that I know these things will come back if and when we do revisit the mission statement, but it doesn't really make much difference which word is in there. What really makes a difference is that we think about these issues. And so I think it's better we don't change it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that for myself, prefer self-reliant. However, conceptually, I don't want to be a part of a group that makes any significant change to this without community input. And so, therefore, I can't support changing it. Please.
I think that community input is essential, and my whole hope was that we would have community input, and even in our meeting tonight or last time or any time it's on the agenda, and I hope that everyone in the community does feel, you know, welcome to email board members or speak at meetings or, you know, write to us about these things and to think about what you think the mission of the school is. And I think that this discussion has been great just because of that. And many people have thought about it and taken a minute to think about it just because we have discussed it twice now. So I want to thank you all very much for entertaining this discussion.
So then, Dr. Valentine, do you have direction?
I have direction. I believe I understand where we're going. I just wanted to reiterate what Mrs. Dickinson was saying.
Okay, then we'll move on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you would like anything pulled. Item 5, approve.
Pull 5, please.
Okay. Item 6, approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization. I would like to pull that one. Okay. Acceptance of donations. 8, disposition of surplus property. 9, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 10, approval of purchase orders. 11, approval of warrants and payroll. 12, approval. Pull 12. Okay.
Move to approve items 7 through 11.
Second.
Okay, those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So, I'm sorry, Mrs. Dickinson. So, item 5, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. You pulled that, Mrs. Butler?
Yes. I want some direction on page 5.2. We've got a lot of certificated substitutes, new hires, and reemployments. And on the very end, the far right column, everybody, and I know they do this with new hires until they're placed, they list them at the district office. But at this time, as of when this board came out, I would have thought that these people would have had a place to be. Rick, is that possible? These people are all assigned somewhere, some school.
No, actually, that section refers primarily to substitute teachers, and so when it indicates district office, it means that that's their kind of residents, although they're being assigned throughout the school district to teach at various sites. Occasionally we have people who request only certain sites to sub at, but except for the one indication of somebody who is being employed as an academic intervention teacher, these are all substitute teachers.
Thank you. Okay, because I was just wondering, I thought why they should have been in place by now. And then, therefore, unless anybody has any other questions, I move we accept item number 5.
Moved by Mrs. Botwin, seconded by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. I pulled item 6, approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization. I do. I just can't get close enough to it, Walter. I know this is something that we do on a regular, a yearly basis, and I have no problem with it. Just in looking at it, though, it brought up another question for me, a different question. As I went through it on page 6.1, we had 1 out of 3 teachers be clad. On page 6.2, we had 2 out of 11 teachers clad certified. Page 6.3, 5 of 14. And on page 6.4, 2 out of 6. I know that as we hire new teachers, we're hiring teachers that are CLAD certified, am I correct?
Primarily. I mean, there are situations where we are hiring teachers who have CLAD credentials, depending on the subject area. All teachers coming out of credentialing programs as of 2003 have a CLAD credential or the equivalent embedded within their credential. But not necessarily. I mean,
striving to get our teachers clad.
Yeah, I wouldn't know that, but I'd be happy to provide that if that'd be an interest of the board of what percentage we have of teachers who are clad certified or certified to work with the EL students specifically.
Would that be how much work, Rick, would that require?
I'm not positive. I'd be lucky if it's in our database, and I think it is. So it's probably a matter of pushing some buttons and pulling it out.
Okay, if it's a matter of that and it doesn't require a tremendous amount of
yeah, I think that's quite
legwork, is there support on the board to see that?
How the percentages are changing over.
Now there you might be pushing the envelope there.
You can always ask.
Okay, I have board support for finding out the percentage of teachers that are clad and be clad.
Certainly.
And then Mr. Millar wonders if your database would allow for the information on how that is changing.
We're always up to that challenge, Mr. Millar.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And with that, I'll move to approve. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Millar.
Thank you. I pull this every year because I'm afraid that an impression in the minds of the public is that we have teachers all over the district who are teaching stuff that they don't really know about. And I know from experience that we actually have many of these teachers have taught these particular classes in the past.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And is there a process that you and your personnel area go through to make sure that these teachers teaching outside of their certificate area are the best trained and experienced to do this?
Well, there is, and actually that's why we list them under separate sections of Ed Code. The one area where we want to make the most sure is where somebody is teaching in a departmentalized class at the secondary level, totally outside of credential authorization, which is those listed on 6.3. And we actually have a committee made up of bargaining unit representatives, teachers from each of our comprehensive high schools and middle schools that review all of these. And principals are required to justify reasons for these kinds of placements. But in all cases, we have to meet EDCO. We can't just place somebody wherever we want them. So in those particular areas, we scrutinize quite heavily to make sure that they are qualified.
And I suppose we should acknowledge that we're lucky to have professional teachers who are willing to take on challenges of teaching outside of their classification. So thank you, Mr. Robinette.
Yes, Mrs. Dickinson.
I just wanted to say that CLAD stands for Cross-Cultural Language and Academic Development Certificate.
Thank you. We use so many acronyms here, and I didn't know that.
Move approval of item 6.
Second.
Moved by Mr. Millar, seconded by Dr. Olker. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. So that just takes us to item 12, which I believe you pulled, Mr. Unger.
I did, and the reason I pulled it, it's the approval of extended field trip application for Morbay High to go to the Midwest Band and Orchestra Clinic in Chicago. I wanted to announce that I'm going as an official school chaperone to that, and so based on that, I'm going to abstain from this vote.
Then I'll move approval of item 12.
Second.
Well, can we approve everybody else but him?
No.
All right, I'll second.
Well, okay, approved by myself, seconded by Mrs. Andreen. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, that passed.
For decisions on the district and specifically our school sites here in Los Osos.
Good one. Chris, I'll
Friday
that.
Packet?
I would be satisfied at least with a start in the Friday packet, but I think that, you know, I'd like to know. It's been a while since we've had the discussion of the impact on the sewer. I believe the last real one we had was, I don't remember if we had it with you, Russell, or when Rory was assistant superintendent. So I think that we should have that. And some things I think I'd like to hear about is not only the specific school sites, Monarch Grove and Baywood, where we are tonight. Thank you very much, Mr. Jennison. But also, I think the effect of it on our Sunnyside property as well.
Yes. Support that.
Okay. So, but we'll start with Friday packet on that one.
Okay.
Okay. Mrs. Andreen.
Thank you. I am interested in hearing a little bit more about what's happening with the exit exam. And I know we have the statistics that were given to us about the different school sites and how many students still haven't passed. I'm kind of curious to know what we are doing with those students, and Friday packet is fine for me on that unless anybody else needs more. And also, I understand they're looking at changing the requirements, so if you know anything more about that and whether that's going to be made more fluid, I'd love to know where that stands. Thanks.
Okay, I think in discussion with Dr. Valentine, it was requested that we receive some information from Mr. Barnett about the number of students that had not passed the CASI, either, you know, and the percentage that were special ed and what have you. There was more information requested about those students, how many had not passed math, how many had not passed English language arts,
right.
And that's now available to us, so we should be getting that in a Friday packet. I think that, I don't know, maybe Dr. Valentine could speak to this, but in discussion with him, I think that the monies that are available, that will be made available, the $600 per student to remediate, is going to be spent by the state on a greatest need basis.
So we might not get it?
That's right. So, that was my understanding. Dr. Valentin?
Yeah, they're prioritizing schools and districts with greatest needs, and they will fund until they run out of money, so it's conceivable that that could happen before it came to us.
We have a duty to remediate, though, whether we get any help from them or not. And I know that we have been, but the details aren't there for me, so I would just like to know, do we have special classes? How are we meeting the needs of those students? And what will actually happen to them if they don't pass it by the time they leave 12th grade? Thanks. And Friday packet's
okay.
Fine.
Friday packet, okay. Dr. Olker?
Just housekeeping. On the agenda items not yet scheduled, the school to career opportunities and apprenticeship, I think, is going to be covered next.
Remain intact so that, because we do get funding for that, too. It affects our public television opportunities. Would we want to see what the city wrote and have a similar letter from the board? I don't know.
I'd be interested.
Okay. I'd be interested in seeing what they wrote and then taking it from there. Friday packet? Does that work, Mrs.
Yes.
Adrian?
If it's in a Friday packet, does that mean we could have an action on it later if we all decide to send it out? Okay.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, then, seeing no other advance agenda items, reports by board members and administrators. Board reports. Mr. Millard.
I was hoping I'd got to go first. I just have a couple of quick items. First, I want to say that I thought the workshop on educational technology was especially interesting and informative and beneficial, and I was very impressed by the energy and enthusiasm of numerous members of our staff, certificated and classified, who were in attendance and participated. It was great. And my other item is, I had hoped tonight, I'm a board member for the SLO County Arts Council, and they have a terrific program called Art Ops, and it provides grants to school sites for visual and performing arts enhancement. Unfortunately, I couldn't open up the spreadsheet that had the information, but the next board meeting, I hope to announce some of the grants that were awarded. And also, we hope to be working with Dr. Matakovich, among others, to help streamline the process and make sure that the fine folks at the Arts Council continue to support arts in the schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Andreen.
Well, I got here late, but I'm making up for it by grabbing the mic all the time. I'm sorry, I was late. I got word kind of last minute that I had to, or had the pleasure of going to a ceremony for my daughter at the Elks Club with the grand poobah and all that stuff. It was wonderful. and then I wanted to say that the Teach Dinner is coming up. Have we had anybody come before us and give us the dates and the info on how to get tickets? Okay, so if somebody wanted to go to the Teach Cooking for Kids Dinner, is it the 27th, I believe? And would they get tickets at the district office? Is that the way to do that?
Well, I had 10, but... my agent has sold all the vast majority of them.
So they're being scalped now?
Any Teach board member, I think.
Right? Dr. Olker may have...
I can get you some.
Can you get me one, please?
Sure. What's the date?
It's Thursday the 27th.
Yes.
It's the 27th, and our featured speaker is Jack O'Connell, right?
And Dr. Isn't
that same date as the dinner at Madonna for the... That's not.
No, it's the 20th, I think.
That's the 20th, yeah.
Oh.
Speaking of grand poobahs.
And I just want to remind everybody, Dr. Valentine, is this true you're speaking?
That's what I'm told, yeah.
Well, I just want to remind everybody of Dr. Valentine's speech at the last one where he was referring to Dr. Ladd's car basically as Chris.
People at different times at San Luis High School and or had them call me. I've left messages on the tape that disappeared. I've had them call me in the middle of conversation. The line went dead. They had to go to their cell phone. I just would like to make the board of the administration aware of telephone problems. Start calling different teachers and using that line. And that when you get the line, when you dial to speak to the teacher on their own personal line, you get an operator who says, and this did happen to me 3 times, the operator says, I'm sorry, that extension is not answering, did not give me to a tape. The 4th time it got me to a tape. So there are some problems up there. Okay, thank you. The last thing is, and I also, as Walter said, I like that meeting that we had on the computer technology. And last Wednesday, I went to the ROP meeting, which was in Atascadero, and it was wonderful. Also, I brought this information back to each one of you. I thought we should know this. This was not mentioned at that meeting that we had on computer technology, and I felt it's important to know because the ROP does one heck of a lot for us in all the schools in our district. If you'll look down the computer, I've got the circle there on the front page. All those computer classes that have an X in them are taught, paid for, supported by ROP. And which is a boondoggle for us. I mean, this is terrific. Also, we got our information from our superintendent. Jim says that our government funding is, at this time, the same as it was last year, and it's gone up a smidgen. So we are in financially, knock on wood, we are in good shape. If you look at all the other classes that are offered that we take there, you'll see everywhere there's an X is a class that we take through the ROP on this page and the other page. And, of course, our ag area, auto maintenance, CAD, CAM, computer drafting, all those things, and careers with children, criminal justice, and teaching careers. And there are others there that are available, but I think it depends on the number of students and the room. So if students were interested in any of these other careers with those ideas in mind, they would be available for them to have a class in it. And I just wanted to add that to the information that we had at our last meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline. This is great information. I appreciate being able to really look at it. Mr. Unger.
And I just wanted to thank the organizers of the Morro Bay Harbor Festival for all their great work. The Harbor Festival is a community event, and money goes back to community agencies through the Harbor Festival. And specifically, there were a lot of folks from Morro Bay High School who volunteered there. The band did the dunk tank and made several hundred dollars, which they split with the Harbor Festival folks. The music boosters took tickets. The cheerleaders were there in force helping out. And then I just saw lots of kids there from Morro Bay High School who had volunteered, were cleaning up and just generally helping out. So thanks to Morro Bay and the Harbor Festival for really supporting our schools and helping to support all the community organizations.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
We are adjourned.
It's the only thing I can do.
Wow. Okay. I'm not drinking, but I'll go and have a little something.
Yeah, I'd go for it.